I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We decided it's high time we do an episode about Mary Jane.
Marijuana, things are happening.
That's right. This episode is about pot. We're exploring the rhetoric surrounding legalization in New York's recent gubernatorial primaries. And a cheesemonger turned cannabis consultant shares the tricks of the trade.
Great. So do you want to conquer the world? Do you want to have hazy eyes? Do you want to, you know, just relax all day and be floaty?
And we find out how one exemplary South Carolina farmer is trying his hand at a new crop.
Every plant that comes up from seed is different. And so it's learning how the plant grows, how it responds, and then familiarizing myself and my senses with this plant.
Plus, Hannah Forden and I taste test the hottest new cocktail ingredient, CBD. So subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the newest episode of Meat and Three drops.
Good evening and welcome to Ferment About It on heritageradionetwork.org, your weekly journey through all things fermented. So in this episode, Mary went solo with her recorder, she stopped by Strong Rope to talk to some New York maltsters, and she stopped by KCBC to talk about the state of craft beer in India. But before we get to that, just one quick announcement. So it's the 30th anniversary of the New York Homebrewers Guild, and they want to celebrate with all of you. The celebration is at The Well on October 14th from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. Tickets are $30, and what those $30 will get you is you get to try so many different homebrews from all these prominent Brooklyn and New York homebrew clubs, like the Bruminaries and Dogs of Wart, as well as Bitter and Esters. And also there's going to be some homebrew alum who are now in the big leagues, like KCBC and even Brooklyn Brewery. So get your tickets at eventbrite.com. Then there's also a Facebook event. Also, hey, if you like the show, we want to hear from you. We have a really good lineup planned for this season, all sorts of very interesting ferments and all sorts of very interesting brews. But we are very interested in any topics or any guests that you might be interested in. So you can find us on Facebook at Ferment About It, or on Twitter or Instagram, also at Ferment About It, or you can email us at fermentaboutit@gmail.com. All right, enjoy the episode. Ferment About It.
I am here in Gowanus at Strong Rope Brewery with Ted Hawley of New York Craft Malt and Mark Sorrells of Cornell University. So I'm going to have you guys tell a little bit about yourself. So Ted, let's start with you. Tell me what New York Craft Malt is and what you do.
Well, thank you for having me, Mary. New York Craft Malt, I believe we are the oldest in recent history of the malt houses in New York State. I'm with New York Craft Malt in Batavia, New York, upstate New York. We've been malting since 2012, and we concentrate on a lot of specialty side of malts. We do have the base malts, but we're doing smoke malts, crystal malts, chocolates, caramels and things like that for the color and taste of New York.
Awesome. And Mark, tell us a little bit about what you're doing at Cornell.
Thanks, Mary. Yes, I've been at Cornell for 40 years. I'm a professor of plant breeding and genetics, and I'm responsible for developing new varieties of oats, wheat, and barley for the state of New York. I think one of the things that we realized in 2012 was that we needed to develop a lot of information about barley, and in 2012 there was no malting barley being grown in New York. So thanks to the New York State Legislature, they have agreed, Ag and Markets has agreed to support us for the last 4 or 5 years. And during that time, we developed a lot of information about malting barley varieties from Europe, Western Canada, Western U.S., to try to find malting barleys that are suitable for production in New York.
Cool. All right, Ted. So what inspired you in 2012 to start New York Craft Malt and growing or malting New York State grown grain?
Well, it was interesting enough. It was in 2011. I attended a Northeast Organic Farming Association conference, and I attended a segment on from farm to bakery, and the facilitator at that time just kind of mentioned there was a need for malting barley in New York State, and then she went on to the rest of her segment, and so I couldn't leave that alone, so I started a dialogue with her and got interested in malting and went on and did more and more research, and so much research where it sent me kind of around the world and designing my own equipment because there wasn't anything off the shelf for malting barley at that time at the craft level. So I designed a lot of it, had it built, and got it up and running in Batavia.
Cool. And what did you do before that, actually? Let's talk about that. Where'd you come from?
Well, I've done quite a bit in my lifetime. Don't have enough time to go over all those. That, but few things that I've done is, first of all, I'm a fourth-generation farmer. I grew up on a farm in Batavia. My grandfather bought the farm in 1909 and went up through the ranks. But I kind of went off on my own for a while. We opened up a health food store in Brockport. I owned a data management company where we did document storage and shredding of that nature, and did a few other things too, but those are the latest things that we got involved with. But it's always wanted I wanted to get back to the roots of farming, and we kind of reinvented the farm into a modern day malt house.
Awesome. Super cool. Yeah. So let's talk about how the last 6 years have been.
It's been a roller coaster for sure. In the beginning, as Mark's mentioned, there wasn't any really malting barley grown in New York State. So I was able to get some seed, and we did put it in 2012. And a local farmer put it in the ground, and we grew it like wheat. And we put a lot of nitrogen on it, and it spiked the protein, and we didn't know what we were doing at that time. But I had a promise to that grower at the time to take that barley and make malt out, which I did, and I paid him off. But it was not the greatest malt because it wasn't the greatest supply. So we're in a position right now with Cornell getting involved with variety trials and breeding for this area to create a unique malting barley for our region. We're slowly getting there with your variety trials from varieties from all over the world and the country. But the breeding program that Mark has going right now is going to be key to the success of the future of a good quality, hearty malting barley that the maltsters can malt well and the brewers are going to love.
Awesome. Let's talk a little bit about the malting process. So some of our listeners might not, I mean, even if you're a home brewer or a commercial brewer, malting's kind of mysterious, actually. So give us the nuts and bolts.
It's interesting that you say that. It is. Not many people know what it is. It's, you know.
I mean, I personally have seen videos and lots of photos and read about the process, but I've actually never been to a maltster. So.
Well, I do want to point out that it's probably one of the oldest trades known to man. I think prostitution is number one, or the oldest. But malting's been around a very, very, very long time. So the modern day methods are different. By far, there's still some floor malting. I do not floor malt. I do pneumatic malting, so I do it in stainless steel vessels, and I can control the environment very, very well. But malting is steeping, germinating, and kilning. So you're actually modifying that grain. What you're doing is you're growing it. It's a sprouted grain, but it's a little past the sprouted measures, as in baking. But we're breaking down the protein walls and opening up the starches in the grain for the brewers to eventually, that turns into sugar during the mash, and the yeast will attack that and ferment and make alcohol. So we're You know, malt is the base of all beers, not hops. Hops is needed. Hops gets all the glory out there. But the malt is the backbone and the base and the flavor and the alcohol content of all beers.
Absolutely. So let's talk about a little bit about your specialty malts. Because specialty malts are a little tougher. And like you said, you started with base malts.
Correct.
And then you branch out into specialty malts since.
So, you know, specialty malts, there's many different ways of creating them. You have your German styles, you have your Viennas and your Munichs. And then you jump up into your crystals, your caramels, and chocolates. And this is in all grains, your wheats, your ryes, and your barleys. But I got in the game with a small little roaster that I made out of a small grill with a rotisserie on it that I built. And I have since, we've expanded into, I believe, the largest malt roaster in the Northeast. It has computer profiling where once I get a recipe, I can repeat it. I just have to press start, and I can create the same product over and over again. And that's what the brewers need, is consistency for their beers. So it's a really nice roaster, and I did have some hand in designing that as well, because it's not a glorified coffee roaster, which I could probably put roast coffee in there, but I have direct and indirect heat, convection and conduction heat, and steam drenching, water drenching, and everything needed to make some quality New York specialty malts.
So it sounds like you have a lot of control over the process.
Right. Control is key, yes.
So what is some of your newest specialty malt that you come out with? You kind of developed a technique for?
Okay. Well, we have recipes that we actually are making for individual breweries. Not all the standards that the commodity guys have. A brewery will request something a little lighter, a little darker, a little sweeter. And I don't want to miss mentioning that we do smoke malts, too. So we do smoke 8 different kinds of woods that
and
we
I
have.
I think I'm actually drinking a beer here at Strong Rope that's made with one of your smoke malts.
Yes, you do. That's I believe it has our cherry smoke malt in there, and I think all of that grain in there is some of our products in each one.
Yeah, so let's talk more about smoke malt. So actually, smoke beers, for those of you who have listened to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about my love for smoke beers. So it's a style that isn't really sexy right now, but man, it is delicious. So let's talk about smoke malts. How do you do an applewood smoke malt versus any other smoke malt?
Okay, well, all our woods are right off our farm, so they are right off our location, and we do season that wood, so it's well seasoned. We don't do any green woods, and we do.
What is seasoning for a city girl like me?
You want to get the. You don't want to try to smoke it right when you cut the tree down. You have all the saps in there, so seasoning is just drying the wood correctly and giving it the certain time that it needs to totally dry down, and then when you smoke it and use it, you drench it in water. And then you're not getting all the saps out. You're just getting quality smoke coming from the wood. But it is a technique. You can do some cold smoked. You can do, my method is a roasted smoke. So we raise the temperature a little bit, and it's about a 4-hour smoking time per batch. But we're also churning it, and we play with it all the time while it's smoking, so we get the most smoke for the... For the time that it's in the smoker.
Awesome.
But the smoked beers, they don't get a lot of publicity out there. Some smoked beers are really smoky, and some other beers, a nice smoked porter is really, really nice and complements each other, done correctly. And the brewers can dial that smoke in with their product. It's really something special.
I agree. Also, a great food pairing beer. Many smoked beers are great for pairing with food.
Right.
How many different smoked malts are you doing right now?
We have 8. You're going to test me on this,
Ooh.
Aren't you?
We've got, I got it. I mean, 8 different smoked beers. That's amazing. Or smoked malts. That's amazing.
Well, we have beech, apple, plum, pear, oak, cherry, and hickory.
Whoa.
But we do have up to 8.
That's amazing because... Yep. So I started homebrewing in 2006. I think at that time we maybe had a choice of 2, Beechwood and peat.
Okay.
And that was it. So it's amazing that, you know, that homebrewers have more choice, but especially that we have a choice of New York State malt that's smoked with all those different woods. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because New York State, we have, it's a great agricultural state. So.
Yes, yes. We've always had the tools here, but we always tend to go to Germany and around the world for our malts. But now it's now you're able to get New York grown grains and products here. You know, that's the local board challenge, and it was there, so I went after it, and now you're able to get these malts right here in New York.
So let's talk about, so you probably tasted a lot of beers that have been made with your malts. So let's talk about maybe something unusual or something that really sticks in your head or that you really were kind of awestruck at.
All beers made with my malt are fantastic beers. To pick one right out, you're putting me on the spot. I know right here at Strong Rope, Jason has been, since his opening, has been a great believer of my malts and has been experimenting with all malts.
Yep.
So he just doesn't do mine. He experiments with all malts throughout New York State. So he's been doing the right measurement of the quality of New York's products.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Everybody likes the East Coast IPAs, and you're talking to a maltster, so, you know, I like a nice malty lager, which would be nice for me.
Yeah.
And I love porters and stouts as well.
Because you do a Pilsner malt, correct?
We do. I don't want to downplay that side of it, but we do have a nice Pilsner.
Let's talk about Pilsner malt.
Okay. Pilsner is one of the lightest of all the malts, so that process is different than all the others. You have to... it's all in the kilning process, you know, from steeping and germinating. It's pretty much the same for a lot of the malts, majority of the malts, and then you're turning it into something during the kilning process. You know, you have a free dry period, you have a forced dry, and you have a curing period. So, and each one of those levels you have to maintain and control very well, or you could lose the enzymes. The more you manipulate that grain, you're starting to lose some properties of that grain's value for many. The more color you give it, you're losing the enzymes enough
And the enzymes are what is converting the starch to sugar in the mash. So
Right. So at the end result is the Pilsner, the curing temperature is lower, and it's a lighter, paler product. But again...
So it sounds like a more delicate process.
It's a delicate process, and it also has to do with the grain, too. I've got some varieties in this spring that I was trying to make Pilsner out of, and it wasn't making a Pilsner because of the variety of the grain was susceptible to moisture, and you put more moisture to it, it creates different... protein levels, and that can raise the color of it. So the ones that I was trying to make Pilsner out of are now pales. It's still a quality product, but I couldn't get the color that I needed. So varietal plays a big issue with that as well. The soluble proteins, whether if they're high or low, will create color or non-color.
So I'm going to rewind a little bit. So I went to grad school in horticulture. I was working with Vidalia Onion, so environment times genetics. You talked about some of your earliest malt was, you were talking about too much nitrogen. So talk a little bit about, although Mark, you can also chime in on this, what makes a good brewing malt versus brewing barley, I guess, versus a livestock barley or any other kind of barley? I went to a barley lecture at the Craft Brewers Conference a couple years ago, but until then, even though I studied horticulture, I mean, horticulture is different than agriculture, but, you know, that's something that not many people think about, right? So a barley that would make a flour for baking is a very different barley that makes a malt for brewing.
That's exactly right, Mary. And these are extremely exciting times to be in the grain industry. Oh, my gosh. I've been in it for 40 years. I've never had so much fun. And it's all driven by three or four factors. One is the interest in locally produced grain and beverages, or food and beverages, because we all love local. It tells us a little bit about our heritage, where we live, and the people we work with. And also because people are very interested in organically grown food and beverages. So our breeding program at Cornell has changed dramatically in the last 5-6 years to focus more on local grains that meet the needs of consumers for both food and beverage. And the driving force was that 2012 legislation called the Farm Brewery Bill that suddenly stimulated the craft brew industry, the malting industry, to buy local and produce local. But it's not just barley. It's wheat, it's oats, it's ancient grains. So it's a multi-dimensional grain landscape out there. And the consumers are benefiting from that. In regards to protein and nitrogen, we've been doing fertility trials to try to identify the accurately identify the level of nitrogen farmers need to use to produce a grain that is at the right protein, which is about 10%. The grain protein varies between 8 and 12%, but the 10% is, I think, a sweet spot for you guys, right, Ted?
10 to 12.
And it's different for winter barley versus spring barley. Winter barley is planted in September, October. Spring barley is planted in April and May. And there's inherently higher protein levels in the springs versus the winters, so we have to fine-tune that fertility regimen for winters and springs. We just can't make a blanket recommendation. So we have a wonderful soft white winter wheat variety called Medina that's excellent for malting into to use for wheat beers.
Although for almost any kind of beer, at Fifth Hammer we use wheat in a lot of our beers.
Do you?
Yeah.
For head retention.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And we've been testing oat varieties for 40 years, and so we know which hulled varieties to recommend for dehulling and making the New England IPA.
Yep.
But also we have been recently testing some naked oats, hullus oats, so that they don't require dehulling, and they can be flaked or ground up for making a nice New England IPA.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Man, where do I go from here? So let's talk about, have you worked with grains for flour or like for bakers as well?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the difference kind of between those.
That's an interesting dimension. It's not just whole grains that are interesting, but also the flour produced from wheat, oats and rye and barley. Barley distillers can use barley also, but most of the soft white winter wheat and the soft red winter wheat grown in New York is ground up into flour that's used to make pastries, cookies, cakes, donuts, all the good stuff.
Yep.
Rye has been for many years grown as a cover crop, a second-class citizen. That
and define a cover crop for people that might not.
Cover crop is just a crop that is planted to hold the nitrogen, hold the soil, so that we don't have erosion and eutrophication in the waters of our streams and rivers. So cover crops are important for that, but also. We can use a grain crop to do the same thing and harvest a really profitable grain crop, and it serves as both a cover crop and a money making crop. I introduced hybrid rye from Germany about 6 years ago, and they yield 30 to 50% more than the conventional rye varieties that have been grown in New York. And plus, they have wonderful grain characteristics. They're nice, plump, high starch grains that are very useful in both malting, brewing, and distilling. So these hybrid ryes are starting to change the way rye is grown and used in New York.
Cool. Also, I feel like rye is kind of an old-fashioned grain. When you think about rye whiskey or rye bread, both of those are enjoying a renaissance right now. So
yeah.
I think people are, you know, coming back to enjoying and really having appreciation for some of the old, you know.
Peter, people love artisan breads, especially sourdoughs and rye breads. And And the ryes also are really useful for creating interesting beers. I love a rye PA.
Me too.
A rye PA is awesome.
Yep.
So I think rye is making a comeback.
Yeah, for sure.
It's making a comeback. And this is another one of the components of the rye, of the grain renaissance that's happening in New York.
Yeah.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
So you're also developing new varieties of grain. We talked about that, or you kind of hinted at that earlier. So talk about what you guys are kind of striving for.
Yeah, most of our focus is on developing new varieties of soft wheat for cookies, cakes, and pastries. But we, in the last, since 2013 or 14, we have been interested in starting up a malting barley breeding program. But we didn't have the resources until about 2015, 2016. And we decided that since we were not finding malting barley varieties from other parts of the world that met the demands for Northeast agriculture and Northeast malting and brewing, that we needed to start our own malting barley breeding program. So we gathered the very best germplasm we could find.
And you got to define germplasm.
Germplasm, okay, so these are varieties from different parts of the world that have some adaptation to New York. Quality is number one. We got to have malting quality. That's number one. If you don't have malting quality, you don't have anything except feed for livestock. So we started with identifying the varieties that had the best malting quality, and we intermated those. So we created breeding populations, segregating populations that gave us the variation that we needed to find individuals that had the combination of characteristics that were required for production in the Northeast. We have ratcheted up the intensity of our barley breeding program. Normally it takes 10 to 12 years to develop a variety. We're aiming for 3 years.
That's amazing.
We're using all the latest technology, all the tricks in the book, and we've pulled out all the stops.
It's
and
a far cry from Mendel.
Yeah, well, but we have Mendel to thank.
Yes, we do.
We love Mendel. But thanks to the New York Ag and Markets and the Genesee Valley Regional Market Authority, we've been able to produce this high-intensity barley breeding program, and we really are very optimistic that we're going to have something to deliver to New York in the next year or so. And we're looking for names. We want a catchy name for our new variety.
New York Craft Malt.
New York Craft Malt.
Is that a good
name? No, New York. How about New York? Maybe. New York Craft Barley.
I'll go with that.
All right.
That'll work too.
Yeah. So thank you. That's
interesting. No, thank you guys. I mean, this is great. It's super exciting. So we actually had Jason on the show a couple weeks ago talking about, you know, what he's doing here. He's doing something very unique in New York City. There are a lot of farm breweries in the state that are using a higher percentage of New York State grown ingredients in all of their beers, but it's pretty rare in New York City. So it's super cool to hear, you know, what's going on in New York State malt production, as well as what we can expect in, you know, the future. I mean, the future is really bright.
Looking well. Looking
and New York State is pretty unique in what we have going on. I mean, we're very lucky in that we are a very agriculture-driven state. We're able to grow a lot of crops here, as opposed to many other states, and that the state has, you know, decided to emphasize that and to really offer some incentives to kind of both sides, right, in order to enhance the availability.
New York State has the farm brewing license, which is along with the craft.
Yes.
So, but anybody doesn't know that, 20% of the ingredients needs to be New York State.
and grown. It's going up to 60% next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of December 31st, that's the end of that, and November or January 1st, it goes up to 60%.
Okay, yep.
So you've got some breweries that are now ramping up to, well, you know, there's some that are 100, some that are 80. They're already there, but there's New York State has over 400 breweries right now,
yep.
And over half of them have farm brewing licenses.
Yep.
So they all have to pay attention to this this license and comply.
Yep.
So,
I think we also have Governor Cuomo to thank for the vision
for sure.
Promoting the beverage industry in New York and with the wineries, the distilleries, the cideries, and the breweries. It's becoming big business.
Yeah.
It's big business.
Yeah.
I don't think any other state has this kind of vision.
They're watching New York State.
They're watching us.
Watching
yeah,
right now.
I agree, for sure. So let's talk about some of the challenges, right? So I feel like as an owner of a brewery, some of the challenges are availability, right? We have a 15-barrel system.
Mm-hmm.
And also actually knowing how, really getting to know the malt, right? I think that's the biggest challenge, personally, is education of brewers. So what's your thoughts on educating brewers to use New York State, your malt specifically,
right,
but also just
right.
New York State grown malt? Because it's a little bit different.
It's different, you know, and I think it's the way it should be. Back in the day, all metropolitan areas had their own malt houses. It was all grown locally, and it was a different malt. You know, the commodity, if you will, commodity kinds of malts now are from all over the world, and they're mass-produced, and they are different.
Yep.
And everybody's used to using that different.
Right. They were kind of trained up on that.
They're
right?
trained, absolutely. And those big guys, they can blend. You can make a phone call, and it's at your door, and they're blending, so it's the same product all the time. So
right. The
challenges are having the same product over and over again that the breweries can count on. The flavor's there, the efficiency's there. The consistency is always the same. We got to get the brewers to be in on trusting us.
Yep.
Because it hasn't been there in the past.
Right.
But with the new grains coming up, we're getting
it's brand. I mean, 2012. It's pretty new.
It's pretty new.
You know,
yes.
Yeah.
So I've gotten better with my equipment, my techniques, the grain's getting better. Everything's being elevated right now where the brewers should be able to handle the quality, and we should be able to produce everything that you're looking for on a continuous level.
So what about sharing? I guess I feel like there should be, and Jason and I have talked about this a little bit, about sharing, you know, more kind of practices, like how best to get the maximum, you know, how to use these malts, because they're like, you know, they're not the same malt that we're used to from other parts of the world, right?
Right.
But we
right.
can make amazing beers from them.
Yes,
so
you can. Yeah.
What do you think?
You know, the brewers
education
have
education of brewers, yeah.
I'm not going to downplay the brewers, but the brewers have to be brewers. The
yes.
brewers have to actually be brewers, not look at a menu and a recipe and
yes.
think it's going to turn out.
Yep.
They have to do their job as brewers, and if there's some adjustments to be made, they make it on the run.
Yep.
And if they see something not working, they have to make the adjustment. You know, it's a partnership between the malt from the growers to the malt house to the
yep.
brewers. We all have to be connected.
Yep.
And we're all part of the story, and we all need to know each other's story.
Yes.
And if there's a disconnect anywhere in there, it's just not working well. But it's we're starting to get better at everything. The brewers are starting to be comfortable with New York malts. They are a little more expensive. And I think that's a hurdle to go over right now. But we have to keep the growers, we need to keep them interested in growing. They're used to growing commodity grains where it's just feed.
Right.
A fraction of what we're offering them, livestock feed. So we got to keep them interested in growing it. And we're giving them a premium to grow it. And maybe, that's where the biggest price is.
Well, it's important that we support our farmers, right?
And support our farmers. You know, you go to the farmer's market every year, you get a different fruit and vegetables every year because it's a different growing season. And you also are paying a little bit more there, but you know you're talking right with the farmer.
Yep.
You're talking with the grower.
Yep.
You know who's growing your foods there. So that's the same thing on the the local malt scene too.
And I think it's also education the public, right? We talk about, you know, people want to know where what they're drinking or eating comes from.
Right.
So it's really important. Beer is kind of one of those things where, you know, New York State's been a very big wine state for a very long time. And people have an appreciation for that. But people don't really think about what's in their beer glass necessarily, right?
Right.
And we now have the ability to make beers from 100% New York State ingredients.
Yep.
And we're supporting the local economy.
Absolutely.
There's nothing more important.
For
and
sure.
And it starts from the ground up, the growers.
Yep.
You know, I think it's all up to the front people, the servers.
Yep.
You know, educate the consumer coming up. Say, yep, this grain is growing local, it's being malted local, and it's brewing local. It's not just brewed local. And there's nothing better than that.
So, what kind of contact do you have with your brewers that buy your malt?
Very good contact. I just actually we're actually making some unique products for specific brewers. That right now. I have a brewer that is that I'm roasting flaked oats for, and he's calling it a oatmeal cookie lager. So I mean, I'm making these really unique products specific to the brewers. So he came to my malt house, and we both worked on the recipe together on my roaster, and he was telling me what he wanted, and I kept testing. He says, "That's what I want." I saved it. It's in my computer. It's under his name, and that's his
that's awesome. His
product.
And that is something that brewers are not going to get from ordering.
No. You've got a wide range of products out there. We're making variations off of them, and we're actually a New York craft malt. We're creating names, trademark names. We're Chautauqua chocolates. We're using the Upstate hard red wheat.
We'll try some of our Upstate soft white wheat.
Soft white wheat.
Yes.
Yeah.
It reminds me, though, earlier this week we had the variety showcase that was at the Project Farmhouse, sponsored by Green Market. And they teamed up breeders with chefs.
Awesome.
And so the breeders provided the chefs with the grains or the vegetables. And the chefs used their creativity to make up something very tasty and delicious. And then people bought tickets to attend and try all of the different kinds of food products that the chefs made. And this is essentially what you're doing. You're working with the brewer to create a novel product that is interesting and tasty and the consumer is going to want.
Yeah, it's very unique times right now. I have one account that went to a big malt house, commodity size, and they said, "No, you're ordering off his list. You know, that's all you can do." But they didn't want exactly what they had, and it's amazing how social media works. I had in my hands, my wife took a picture of my hands with my chocolate wheat, and that went out there, and I get the call from this company, and it's going to be quite a large account for us to be able to produce what they want, and the big guys would not.
Awesome. That's great.
So it's great times right now, and the brewers can start relying on good quality products from New York State more and more.
Yeah, for sure. So if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
Well, we have a website, newyorkcraftmalt.com. You can order through us through orders at newyorkcraftmalt.com. We can sell to home brewers as well. We have the online store on that website.
Do you have an Instagram?
Instagram, yep. My social media director, a.k.a. my wife. She does all the social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and would love to hear from people and what their needs are and enjoy the good times that we are right now in the brewing and growing and malting industry.
And Mark?
Yeah. I just wanted to point out one other important component for New York State, and that is the Cornell Cooperative Extension agents that train the farmers how to grow malting barley. They have been the key organization that has made malting barley possible in New York. And we went from maybe 30% barley meeting specs the first year to 70% the next year. And I haven't heard the statistics for this year, but We thank Cornell Cooperative Extension for their efforts in educating farmers, because it's not easy.
No. No, the farmers are used to growing commodities.
Commodity grain.
Meaning livestock grain, basically.
Or flowers, okay. You know, your wheats and things.
Things that don't have to grow again.
Right. Yeah. I mean, okay. It's just such a, you know, the way I send it home to the farmers are, you're no longer a commodity grain grower. You're a certified seed grower. I need to grow this grain. Mm-hmm. So it kind of sends it into a different spin. And for the particulars that you have to put up with, I'm giving you up to five times the value of what that product is as just feed.
Yeah.
So,
which is probably the true value of that.
Yeah. It's bigger grain. Farming practices mark it right on it. You've got some old farmers that have been growing for five generations, and this is how we grow grain, you know. So the ones that are succeeding are the ones that are open-minded, and they're listening, because too much nitrogen will add too much protein. It'll also maybe add too much height, and it'll lodge and fall over because it's growing too much. And we have these microclimates all over New York State, too, that grow differently, even the same variety. Differently in other parts of the state. So Cornell Cooperative Extension is key to keeping the farmers abreast of best growing practices. Yes.
Awesome. Well, I cannot thank you guys enough for sitting down with me here at Strong Grove Brewing in Gowanus, Brooklyn. And thanks again, guys. Ferment About It. All right, this is Mary, and I am at Kings County Brewing Collective in the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York. I am here with...
Hey, I'm Nakul from Great State Ale Works, a brewery in India.
And tell me, where in India?
So we are based in a city called Pune, which is 3 hours away from Mumbai or Bombay. And we are a production-only brewery. We are 10 months old now. We are supplying to 4 cities close to our city. And I actually started brewing in Crown Heights when I was living here about 4 or 5 years ago. And that's when I met Tony from KCBC. And then we've kind of been in touch. And then when he came down last couple of months ago, we did a collab brew with him, which was India's probably first proper New England IPA.
Awesome.
And then I happened to visit my brother who lives in the US. And then we did a collab with KCBC. Which is a IPA with rice flakes and mangosteen.
Ooh, which mangosteen?
Mangosteen.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And you guys just did that?
Like 2 weeks ago.
Very cool.
And I think I'll miss the tapping because I'm heading out in 2 days. But by Wednesday, the beer should be ready. So
tell me, how did you... So you started brewing when you were in Crown Heights here in New York.
Yeah.
And then when you went to India or back to India, I'm not sure if that's where you're from.
Yeah.
But what... You know, how'd you keep going? Did you keep home brewing? And what was sourcing ingredients like?
Yeah. So I actually home brewed way more in India than here. I did a few batches here. I used to go to Bitter and Esther's. Mm-hmm. And John gave me my first kit and all that. And then I moved back and I started home brewing. So I couldn't take my kit because it's too much, you know, luggage to carry. So in India, at least 3-4 years ago, you had to go to different markets, like the steel market for a boil kettle and the plastic market for a, you know, food grade fermenter and all these things. But then you kind of source all this. There are a bunch of craft breweries that started 5 to 8 years ago. They're really nice. So my first set of ingredients came from them directly. So that's they helped us. But now things have changed. New home brewers. There are a couple of websites that are giving equipment, that are supplying ingredients directly. Plus there are way more home brewers. Way more breweries. So breweries like mine are always giving, we always give out, you know, ingredients to home brewers and just as long as they give us a few pints.
Awesome. Yeah. So tell me what you brew.
So I love IPAs. So when Great State started, we made it a point to always have one IPA on tap at all our accounts. So that was more for personal want. Wheat beer, which is what sells the most in India, whether it's a German or Belgian, is our cash cow. So we have our version of a Belgian wit, which is these two, a pale ale and the wit, are our flagship beers. A third one keeps rotating. So we did a Saison in the summer. We did a Kolsch a couple of months ago, and now we are on a golden ale, Belgian golden ale. And when Tony came, we switched out our pale ale with the New England IPA. And we've just been doing that. We're on our fourth brew.
Awesome. So talk about sourcing your ingredients there.
Everything. Okay, so hops are fully imported. So we have our hops come from Europe. So if they're American hops, there's a European distributor who then sells it to an Indian distributor, and then we get it. Mm-hmm. Decently fresh hops, not super fresh, but like the same year harvest.
Yep.
Now, that's pretty good. Yeast is all imported. So most breweries will use dry yeast because it's easiest.
Yep.
Some breweries, right? Yeah. And some breweries have their own labs. So kind of, you know, they get liquid yeast, they propagate, and then they use that. And malt, so base malt, we can use 6-row base malt, which is grown in India, which is sold also to the big commercial breweries. So we kind of use that for our base beers. And then any kind of specialty malt is imported. So it's Weimann or it's Kassel, which is what is coming into India. There's also Irex from Germany.
Cool.
So, yeah.
And then what is the craft beer market look like in India? I mean, I feel like, you know, here it's evolved pretty drastically over the last, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. So what does it look like over there?
So India has, I think, 3 pockets of brewing. One is in Pune, Bombay. One is in Bangalore. These two are good pockets. A lot of Indians who were studying in the US, who started home brewing, sort of quit their jobs, moved back home, and set up breweries. So you see a lot of experimentation with breweries in these two pockets, where we are trying to use local ingredients and we're, you know, trying to do new things, and, like, you know, because we're all home brewers. There's also North India, where there's a different pocket where we don't relate to, because they're more in it for the commercial point of view, and their beers are not good. And so that's how I would distinguish the two types. And it's good. Within Bombay and Pune, we have now, I think, about 30 breweries. In Bangalore alone, there are about 40 breweries. So that's just one big city, but this 40 is a good number.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
Yeah, and it's growing. Only difference that I relate to from my time here versus my time in India, there are not as many home brewers. So the home brewing community is very tiny. So they are not able to make an impact either by setting up their own breweries or going and demanding good beer, because they know what good beer is. The Indian consumer doesn't know what a double is, because he's never had a Belgian double. So his first introduction of a brewery making a double is his reference point. So I think that's a challenge that we all face, because we have to tell them that, you know, this is different than what you've been drinking, but this is actually what it should be.
Yep.
Yeah. But we are so new and young that we all just try to focus on, you know, making good beer, not bothering too much with guidelines, BJCP guidelines,
yep,
because we can't, it's too new for us to try to do that. As long as the beer doesn't have off flavors, as long as it's clean, it's good. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then I'd ask you about bars. So you're distributing, self-distributing,
yes,
in India.
Yes.
So what is the setup with bars?
That's, I think, one of the biggest challenges for me as a brewer is that I'm not just a brewer. I'm also an operations guy, because bars in India don't have dispensing setups at all. So
they don't have cold rooms.
They don't have cold rooms.
They don't have glycol lines.
No way. Nothing. So they don't have kegerators. They don't have taps. They have nothing. So a brewery that started 5 years ago, or maybe 4 years ago in Bombay, kind of showed us, the new guys, the path, where they went and convinced various bars, about 80 bars in Bombay alone, to set up kegerators. And because of them, and they're not giving these kegerators for free, because as small breweries, we can't set up these things. Like, if you see big breweries like Kingfisher and Budweiser, they're coming to India and giving free dispensing setups, which we can't. So the bigger struggle has been done by the first couple of guys. For us, it's easy. It's still a bit challenging, but it's easy. So what we do is we go and tell a restaurant that, okay, you should have craft beer. If they're convinced, we will set up their whole dispensing system. We'll train their guys on dispensing, on CO2 and all that. And then I have a dedicated service guy who's just running around from one account to the other, making sure lines are clean, making sure, you know, we're training them. And so that's a challenge, because it's not just making beer, filling it in a keg, and distributing. It's also, is it being poured well? And what's happening. Yeah, but I think there are 6 or 7 bars now in Bombay and Pune that have set up their own distribution systems, own dispensing setups, which is great. So we and a bunch of other breweries are encouraging them to set up their own sets, dispensing units, so that, you know, they're not bound to me, right, to take beer from me. Just have 6 taps and take the 6 best beers, because I know out of 6, I know I can get 2 taps, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's your next, what are you looking forward to? What do you want to do as far as beer styles or, you know?
Yeah. Great State, my brewery, is very focused on using local ingredients. So we've used very unconventional ingredients, which are typically used in Indian cooking, you know, like souring agents in cooking to make a sour beer. We've used like lemon zest from special limes from East India. So I want to continue that and being...
So when you say souring agents, talk a little bit about that.
So there's a ingredient called kokum. Kokum is a cousin or from the same family as the mangosteen. Kokum is... The skin of the kokum fruit is dried and then used in fish curries on the coastal side to make sour fish curries. Kokum is also used to make a kokum syrup for a summer drink, a non-alcoholic beverage that we all grew up drinking called kokum sherbet. Sherbet meaning juice, so kokum juice. So we are adding kokum into our saison. So it's got this beautiful red color from kokum. It's got this mild sourness like a Berliner Weiss or a Goza without actually going into kettle souring or into using, you know, lacto or Brett,
yep,
which is great. So things like that is what we are focused on.
Awesome.
And being here in the US, you know, I always go to breweries that are trying a lot of different styles. So I'm trying this lactose and coffee blonde ale. So I'm like, great, that's interesting, because those kind of things will work in India.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the New England IPA. After Tony brewed a batch with us, we're on our fourth batch now, and it's good response. So we'll continue making low bitter but super juicy IPAs, and maybe even try using ingredients which can complement the hops when we dry hop, and see how that goes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me. So, if people were to find you on the internet, where would they go?
We are on Instagram, on Facebook. It's greatstate.aleworks.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. With no wind on the banks of forgiveness, you clutch to your burden, the waters of pain.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. 3 of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. and I hope you saved a little room for dessert.